Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise, informative update. It's Monday, the 8th of April. Coming up on the program, the fire and weather crisis in the Western Cape. The mayor of Stellenbosch is with me in just a moment. And then how the insurance industry is going to move in and assess damage and risk. We'll also look at why South Africa is losing foundation phase teachers, new thinking on the growing digital divide problem, and why 20,000 people a year are leaving South Africa. It's been nothing short of a devastating weekend in the Western Cape. Fire has left more than 1,000 people in Khayamandi in Stellenbosch destitute. Strong winds, heavy rain expected in and around the Cape Town Metro and other Western Cape municipal districts. I can also tell you that schools in the Western Cape's Overberg, Cape Winelands and Helderberg districts will be closed today after a level 9 warning by the South African Weather Service for what it terms disruptive rain that could result in widespread flooding, damage to property and loss of livelihood. Let's start our coverage on the story with the mayor of Stellenbosch, the executive mayor, Gesie van Deventer. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining me. I understand that you have been in a meeting today with various emergency officials. What's the overall assessment in and around the region?
Good morning, Jeremy, and all listeners. Yes, it's been a very challenging weekend, if I can put it that way, but we are on top of it. I'm very happy to say that our staff and our community has been assisting amazingly, and everything is business as usual. The roads are all open. We are still battling with a couple of electricity issues, outages, mostly Eskom areas. Fallen trees have been removed from the roads. And yes, everything is almost back to normal, except for the debris we have to remove. And of course, the Khayamandi issue we have to deal with.
Well, talk about the Khayamandi issue if we can. 1,000 people left homeless. That fire must have been very serious.
It was quite serious, Jeremy. And with the gale force wind, you know, it was measured at our local airport at 330 kilometers. I mean, it is like a terrible wind, and the fire just spread so quickly. The history behind this is that this is, as we know it, the ozone in Khayamandi, and it's been there for many, many years, long before my time, I think from about 2000 or even before then. And we have started upgrades in that area. The first phase we're busy with putting in infrastructure. That would have been the second phase of upgrading, building house for the people. So it's actually quite sad that this happened now. However, what we have done is we arranged for the people to go and sleep in a hall. Those of the residents who did not want to go to family or friends, because people are scared they lose the last of their possessions. So people were sent to a hall or to family and friends. Then we arranged that there should, of course, be a verification process to make a list of all the people affected. We got gift of the givers, and I would like to thank them so much to come in and bring additional food to the people. But I have to say immediately that we feed the people three times a day, prepare the meals, we take it to them. And although we know it's about 800 people, we take 1,200 meals three times a day. So irrespective of anything else, we carry on with the process.
So, Mayor van Deventer, we're hearing from the South African Weather Service now that more rain and wind is expected both today, tonight and tomorrow. I'm assuming that you do have contingency measures in place to deal with that should the situation become worse.
Yes, we do indeed. And so as far as Kayamandi is concerned, we have that in place, so food and shelter. We are also now busy giving the list to the provincial government, who will be assisting us to give the people material for new structures, temporary structures. We have everything in place, Jeremy, and I'm really grateful to say we got so much support from our community, from NGOs like Stellcare, from Gift of the Givers, and everything is business as usual. Yes, it's not easy, but we're carrying on, and we hope to have most of the issues sorted out by Wednesday.
Mayor, I know that in Cape Town itself there is an audit undergoing, a critical or an essential infrastructure audit that is underway. I'm assuming that you would have been out and around in your area of jurisdiction looking at things like roads and bridges.
Yes, I have been out and about, and that's why I say, all the major roads are open. Fallen trees, we lost a lot of our huge oak trees, but in the roads, inner city roads, they've been cut up. The teams are out there now on a program. We also brought in additional teams, contractors to help us cut up all the trees next to the roads. The roads are fine. That's not an issue. Electricity is fine, except we're battling Eskom areas like Kylemore. It's horrible there because it's Eskom. Raithby is an issue, and Flottenburg, but we're speaking to Eskom to try and assist. And I'm very happy to say, once I've been on a visit, once I've spoken to my team, that Stellenbosch can carry on, and it'll be open for business. People can come and visit us.
And just finally, very sad about the Blaaklip and wine estate.
Oh, that was so traumatic. Really, it's the oldest wine estate in Stellenbosch, and I think in South Africa. It's really very sad, that we lost that. And I'm particularly sad about the heritage part, all the pottery, all the copper, all the floorboards, the ceilings. I mean, it's a loss that one can never describe. But yeah, I phoned the owner on Sunday morning, and I spoke to him. Ask if we can assist, but of course I have to do an assessment and go to insurance. But also a bigger part of that going down towards Jamestown has been burned, and we're also rendering assistance there to the people who's been affected.
All right. Thank you very much indeed for that update. One of the worst affected areas this weekend, the Greater Stellenbosch area. That's the Executive Mayor, Gesie van Deventer. Well, as you've heard her say then, the entire region, the province, grappling with these severe weather conditions, and there has been widespread havoc and disruption across the region. More inclement weather conditions are expected overnight. So what now, just in terms of risk assessment and managing the process going forward? I'm in conversation now with the risk principal from the company RiscoNet, Volker van Verden. And Mr. van Verden, first of all then, what would the most significant risks be that communities face when dealing with simultaneous natural disasters, as we've witnessed this weekend, both fire and storm?
Yeah, I think when you look at community exposures and severe weather like this, call it the cumulative or the contagion effect of a major storm is a key concern. So you'd find that communities can provide for some rain and some storms, but when a major system like this comes in and affects, let's say, a kilometer or two of informal housing, then you've got 10,000 people, all of whom are now in flooded circumstances or find it difficult to move or lose a lot of their possessions. Those are the crisis issues. And that's often what is missed when we're planning for significant weather events, is that the cumulative impact, the way the water rises, the level of severity of wind affects thousands of people at the same time.
So how can communities then better plan and prepare for these compounded effects that you talk about?
It's difficult for them because of the pressure on housing and access to land that's, reasonably close to cities and so forth. And with sympathy to the city planners, there are a lot of people who occupy land in an unmanaged way. So if we're doing that, planning for a stormwater runoff, planning for, managing housing units, keeping them at higher ground and things like that is important. We hear often that people are often occupying land close to riverbanks, and then we have a storm and significant damages caused and their injuries at the same time. So one would like to educate and show people that that's not risk planning, but people need access to water or want access. So it's a contradictory situation, particularly for the poorer communities. So I think there are significant challenges in that respect, other than improving formalized housing.
Volker, in terms of current risk assessment, particularly looking at areas like the Winelands and Cape Town itself right now as we have this conversation, it would be difficult then to prioritize which areas or aspects of a community need immediate attention in the aftermath of something like this. How does that impact the way in which risk assessment is handled?
Yeah, I think that is very important because it happens now that we have very high winds with rain. But the what's even worse scenario is high winds in a heat wave with fires, because that kind of destruction and that contagion that can run through communities and destroy livelihoods and so forth is even worse. So one would look at these situations and say, how do we better prepare? How do we get the best possible advanced warning of these situations when you've got 150 kilometer winds coming through with rain and damage to housing? That is it. I mean, you've got to try and keep people safe inside, protected in a way. But when one knows about these, getting warnings out, having alternative shelters, looking after people who just don't have any shelter, those are all important things. But when it escalates to raging bushfires and so forth, then it's very, very difficult. And then one's trying to marshal significant resources in a different way. So the planning for these things is a fundamental issue. So it would be, you know, arranging of helicopters, getting emergency vehicles in, getting the standby resources deployed, the town centres and many similar environments like that. So, yeah, it's a tough one, but I think some of the extremes and the impacts can be avoided by seeing how the severity of these storms and heat waves and so can destroy property.
And a lot of that, Volker, would be predicated surely when it comes to advanced planning and warning on the role of technology and better data analysis in improving response.
100%. I think what a lot of us don't understand is that as wind speed rises or as other weather effects rise, the effect is not linear. It's actually on a log scale. So let's say wind is running at 50 kilometers and then it goes to 100. The damage is not double. The rate of damage is like quadruple or multiples. So the modeling of weather and the modeling and the understanding of what increasing severity of weather will and can do is a fundamental. So now we look at many video clips where trees are lying all over the roads and roofs are disappearing. But, you know, next door to us, you know, across where we have hurricanes, people nail down their roofs every year. So we haven't had that assumption because our 100-year flood line and our maximum wind speeds haven't asked us to do that. But under the modeling and the forecasting scenarios, those kind of additional strengthening techniques should be put in play and our buildings should be much more resilient in the same way.
I am going to leave it there and thank you very much for that assessment, Volker von Vidden. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, I want to pivot now from the weather to education, and far fewer grade R, 1, 2 and 3 teachers are being produced by the country's higher education institutions than what is required. At the same time, due to budget cuts, the Department of Basic Education has cut the number of bursaries it will be awarding to student teachers in this financial year. I'm joined now by Basil Manuel, Executive Director of the National Professional Teachers Organization of South Africa. Basil, a very warm welcome. What's the main reason for the current shortage of these teachers in the foundation phase?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and thanks for having me. Jeremy, at first, when you look at the overall number of teachers, given the number of posts, there's no shortage of teachers in South Africa. But of course, that is when you are simplistically looking at the stats. When you mine down a little deeper, you find that there are a whole lot of teachers out of alignment. In other words, they are teaching things that they didn't train for. So we have a few thousand teachers in the foundation phase who were not trained for the foundation phase. And of course, you can simply say, okay, they need some upgrading, etc., because they have been taught. However, they have been trained. However, it's not as simple as that. For some, they need far, far more work. We complain about reading problems, but the reading problems are also associated with people who can't teach reading. It's a particular skill. So training fewer foundation phase teachers is, I suppose, because of the lack of the colleges. The colleges were particularly designed for training that was far more practical than universities are. Universities are academic institutions, and that is one of them. But I want to stress, it's not only the foundation phase. We are looking at, and it has gained traction, that we more and more people are speaking about mother tongue education, to start off and having a longer period of mother tongue instruction before transitioning. You need language teachers from the vernacular languages, you know, the indigenous languages. In addition, of course, we have the age-old ones of maths and science and the technologies that are changing.
Basil, why do we have this misalignment problem in the first place?
Well, I've accused the DBE, and they've defended strenuously that they are not talking enough to the Department of Higher Education and universities. And they insist that they are. In fact, DHE also says, yes, but we are talking. So my question is, then why the misalignment? Particularly when bursaries are being given by Funza Lushaka, for example, you can then direct those bursaries only to a specific group, those that want to train in, let's say, coding and robotics and foundation phase. But the reality is the vast majority of teachers don't get bursaries. Funza Lushaka accounts for a small percentage, and then it's NSFAS that accounts for a much bigger percentage where there's far less direction that can be given. Then, of course, an even larger group is unfunded, goes themselves, pays for themselves, their parents pay. And so it becomes more difficult. So you need the universities to actually be at a point where they say, there is no demand for X, so we're only training for Y. But the universities don't want to do that because this is an income stream.
And not a simple issue, I imagine, trying to get that demand coordination right.
No, not at all. Research by Stellenbosch University, the RECEP unit, from where I'm quoting by and large, they have put it such that they say, simply just getting administration to follow what was decided in management meetings are an enormous problem. And because administration is about pay your fees, we register you for that and that, and those are your choices, and there you go along. But it is extremely difficult. And then we have private institutions over and above the public higher education institutions. There are a myriad of private ones also training.
All right, Basil Manuel, I am going to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining me from the National Professional Teachers Organization of South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So aligned to that particular issue is the so-called digital divide, that gap between those who have access to and can effectively use technology, digital tools and platform, and access digital literacy training, and those who do not. And all of this has the potential to exacerbate existing and historically rooted socioeconomic inequalities. It's a very blunt assessment from George Barrett, who is Country Director, South Africa, of the British Council. She joins me now on the program. And first of all, George, why are you raising or ringing the alarm bells?
I think it's a really important issue, not only for society in South Africa, but, you know, across the continent, as my article suggests, and indeed in other parts of the world. And this is something that we're really committed to in the council, because we work across education, in the broader cultural engagement, we work across education, higher and basic, and in the art space. And in across all of these sectors, we see the critical need for digital literacy to enable young people in particular who tend to be the audience that we work with, to be able to access the opportunities, be they skills development, employment, networking and communication, entrepreneurship. And these opportunities are effectively being denied if people don't have the right access and capabilities in terms of digital literacy to be able to utilize these platforms and technologies, both hardware and software, effectively, in the different aspects of their lives.
And the implication if the divide gets wider is what?
The divide itself is partly a product of the existing socioeconomic inequalities that we experience and the history from which they have come. And, you know, modern contemporary challenges that we continue to face that exacerbate them. And in a way, the digital divide will then reinforce those existing inequalities because, or deepen the inequalities and poverty, because it will continue to exclude people. So it's almost that it offers exponential opportunities to those that do have access and can take advantage of that access. But it really is opportunity limiting for those that can't, because if we think not only just in terms of education, access to digital healthcare, certain things that people require now, if you want to, you know, open a bank account, they often say, oh, you'll get sent an OTP. If you don't have a mobile phone, you can't do that. So then you're suddenly starting to be excluded from very basic activities that and functions that we have in society. So it's quite critical, I think, that we ensure that we are closing the digital divide or bridging the digital divide to ensure that we don't further entrench existing inequalities and poverty.
Of the two problems or concerns that you raise, access and capability, which is more important, which would be more concerning?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I think because they go hand in hand. So I'm afraid I don't think I can say one is more important than the other. You can have access, but of course, if people don't have the capability to utilize the machines, we have a situation in some instances where we have computer laptops being put into schools, but because both the educators and the learners aren't confident and don't have the capability to use those machines, or and then the schools to have the resources to maintain them, they're sitting in a cupboard. And this was one of the kind of points that I made in the article. So I think, you know, access is critical, and that's a whole array of things: infrastructure, cost of data, sustainable electricity supply, sustainable network and an effective network. But then you hit the second barrier, that even if you put that in place, if people don't know how to use it safely and effectively, you're not bridging the divide. So I think we have to look at these two things in parallel and be working with them simultaneously, rather than thinking one is the chicken before the egg.
And George Barrett, it's not just about throwing money at the problem, it's also about changing an entire mindset and philosophy.
100% money, and you know, you can put all the money. We've seen this when we hear data that says, oh, if we put X money in, we could solve the world's poverty. Well, the world just doesn't simply work like that. So money alone is not going to address the issue. Partnerships, coming together, different stakeholders that bring different benefits to the table, ideas, innovation, technology, skills, expertise, and so forth, to create innovative solutions. I think that's where we really need to be focusing. So it's not just about putting money in. You know, the councillors we work on a shoestring budget, but we have impact because we work in collaboration and through partnerships. And I think that that's really critical. So bringing the government together with private sector, with civil society, with the organisations such as ourselves, to say, how can we work together to find solutions? And it's not one panacea either, because we really need to contextualise the solutions based on the different needs of the communities that we're working with.
And all of that argument, I imagine, is predicated on having good policy.
100%, yes. I mean, we need a strong policy framework and, you know, a realistic implementation plan or implementation plans to support the kind of greater digitalization and access to the digital economy. And we're working with the Department for Basic Education, for example, to put together guidelines around digital teaching and learning to support that agenda very early on in the school development, you know, school curriculum, if you will. And I think that's really important because it's empowering for the educators and the learners. It creates the parameters with which we engage with these technologies and how they can be utilized effectively. And it helps to standardize across the school system, if you will, or the education system, so that everybody is getting a fair opportunity and access and the same kind of quality of training and expertise. But also importantly, that point about safeguarding and safe access is so critical when we're thinking about particularly young people and young learners as they're going through their school education, really knowing and learning those skills of being able to access information safely.
George Barrett from the British Council, thank you very much for joining me.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is data which is vital to the growth of the South African economy. Stats SA has published its migration profile report for South Africa, and that essentially reveals the number of people who have left the country compared to those who have returned. I'm in conversation now with Diego Iturralde, who's Chief Director, Demography and Population Statistics at Stats SA. Diego, a very warm welcome to you. And are you able to give me a sense of balance between those who've left and who they are, and those who are coming into the country and who they are in terms of the skills that they have and offer?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Thank you for having me, and good afternoon to the listeners. Yes, Statistics South Africa has put together this migration profile report, which highlights the inflows and outflows of migrants and also looks at some of the characteristics of these migrants where applicable. So if we have a look at the inflows and of migrants, we can see that from the 2022 population census, we are looking at approximately 2.4 million persons born outside the country who reside in the country at this point in time. We can say that the majority of these are lying between the ages of 20 and 39, most of them coming from the various countries in the region. Mm. In terms of the labor market, we know that the majority, or that the highest proportion, are working in the construction sector, with about 18% of all people in the construction sector being born outside the country. And I think that, you know, there's for a long time been a perception that migrants are dominating certain sectors at the expense of South Africans, and we can see that the opposite is actually true, that many of these sectors and occupations with a low entry level, a low criteria for participation in those sectors, are appealing to migrants, but not to the extent that that they are overwhelming specific sectors of the economy.
Just in terms of value to skills to the economy, though, the country is also losing something in the region of 20,000 people a year. That's 400,000 over the past 20 years. The skills that they're taking with them are also of concern, surely, to the economy of the country. It's difficult to find that balance between inbound and outbound.
Absolutely. You know, I always say that each coin has got two sides. And whilst we are losing skilled persons, we know that there's an immigrant stock of about 914,000 persons living in other countries at the moment. And we can safely assume that most of these are skilled individuals. There's a significant proportion of them also who are students and people who are just traveling and exploring the world, especially younger people. But replacing these skills is highly challenging, because we are all competing in a global village where we are competing for those skilled individuals. I think the other side of the coin is that if we have a look at remittances, we can see that remittances are very useful to the country receiving it, because they really fund local economies. They enable local economies to operate as they are. And we can see that in 2022, in terms of inflows into South Africa, we had about $873 million coming into the country. And amongst migrants in South Africa who are remitting to other countries, or it could also include South Africans sending remittances to their relatives who have migrated elsewhere, we had just over $1 billion that were being sent in that particular year. So that's also an extremely powerful developmental tool that migrants are able to leverage on. in terms of where they might be living.
And just the third piece of the triangle, so to speak, is this concept of return migration. How is that contributing to our broader understanding of migration patterns and value that is derived? My understanding is that only a fraction of those who've left are actually making that decision to return, in spite of what a very optimistic real estate market is saying in this country.
Absolutely. So what the real estate market is saying right now are developments that are taking place at this point in time. And we would have to wait until the next data collection cycle to take place to see to what extent have South Africans returned. Where are they living? Are they taking up these high-end properties in the Western Cape and in Gauteng? But we see that there's a significantly small amount in the vicinity of 20,000 to 30,000 South Africans who have returned in the last 10 years, or the people who have come to South Africa who claim that they are South Africans, that they were born in South Africa, and of course, if there is a trend towards return migration, then this trend is starting off at a very low base and still something that we need to keep our eyes on.
Thank you very much indeed for joining me. That's Diego Iturralde, Chief Director, Demography and Population Statistics at Stats SA. And that also informs our online poll for today. As I've just mentioned, around 400,000 skilled people leaving South Africa in the past 20 years. I'd like your view on that. Expected, worrying, or anecdotally, do you believe that the return rate is improving? If you'd like to participate in that poll, go to MoneyWeb on X, also on our LinkedIn page, and I'll bring you the results on the program tomorrow. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.